Astory Publishing presents The Marriage That Shook a Kingdom. Prologue. The Thames lay black and still beneath a pewter sky on the last morning of January, 1547, when the bells of London began to toll for Henry, 8th king of that name. From the high windows of Whitehall Palace, the river looked like a broad ink stroke dividing past from future. And along its frozen reach a procession of barges gathered, each hung with sable cloth and steadying in the current, like mourners who dared not speak. Somewhere within the lead-lined coffin on the gilded state barge rested the body that had once danced beneath painted ceilings, hunted in Windsor Forest, and clasped 6 different women's hands in marriage vows that changed the face of Christendom. At Westminster Stairs, an aging clerk named Humphrey Wingfield, he who had once written the king's first secret petition for annulment, stood bareheaded despite the cold, fingers crooked with rheumatism around a parchment roll. He heard the funeral drums echo across the water and thought how every beat seemed to summon another queen from memory. Catherine of Aragon, resolute and Spanish, quick-witted Anne Boleyn with her French polish, pale Jane Seymour, whose short triumph delivered a prince, grave Anne of Cleves, misjudged by portrait and rumor, laughing Catherine Howard, too young to gauge the peril of whispers, and book-loving Catherine Parr, now dowager, who waited among the council to sign the new boy king's first proclamations. Wingfield's role contained statutes ratified for each of them, annulments, successions, treason clauses, parchment proof that in Tudor England matrimony had become an instrument of government. A winter wind pushed smoke from the riverside chimneys, carrying the scent of damp wood and tallow down to the quay, where a cluster of foreign envoys watched in guarded silence. Their eyes, practiced at reading ceremony-like cipher, noted every gesture. The Duke of Norfolk's absence, the bishop's hastily altered litany that named the king, not the pope, as supreme head of the English Church, the single white rose laid upon the coffin by the gilt-robed child who was now Edward VI. To the imperial ambassador, these details signaled the unresolved question that haunted the realm. Could a nation rebuilt by one man's private passions endure without the heat of his will? Upriver at Greenwich, another witness waited, an elderly woman in a modest wool cloak. Few recognized her as Maria de Salinas, once lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon, now heavy with years yet unwilling to let the king's passing go unmarked. She remembered a different winter morning almost 4 decades earlier, when the same river had glittered with frost as her mistress first set foot on English soil. Then the air had smelled of oranges packed in Spanish caravels, and monks in white linen had chanted the Latin of an unbreakable sacrament. The realm had seemed solid, its faith indivisible, its future clear. How swiftly the tide had turned! Not far away, in the loft of St. Peter's Chapel, choristers rehearsed a somber motet by Thomas Tallis. The boys did not sing in Latin, but in the new sanctioned English. In the midst of life, we are in death. The words floated over the water toward the barges, a reminder of reforms that had begun as footnotes in legatine courts and blossomed into an English Bible on every lectern. Many Londoners lining the banks could not have defined act of supremacy or legatine jurisdiction. Yet they understood that the familiar world of saints' shrines and papal blessings had tilted, and that the tilt had started with a king who refused to accept silence from Rome when silence blocked the birth of a son. As the coffin passed, oars dipping in funereal rhythm, the river seemed to carry more than a monarch's remains. It bore the sediment of choices laid down year after year in privy chambers, consistory courts, and hastily summoned parliaments. Choices made by clerks like Wingfield, by artists such as Hans Holbein, whose painted panel once convinced a king to wed, and above all, by 6 queens whose varying accents, devotions, and ambitions left fingerprints on every statute roll and chapel reredos. The barge slipped beyond sight, turning toward Windsor. Slowly the crowd dispersed, boots crunching on frost, yet a hum of uneasy anticipation lingered. Would Edward, 9 years old, Protestant in Tudors, frail in frame, hold the center that his father had forced into shape? or would the alliances woven and severed in six royal beds unravel at the first tug of foreign war or domestic doubt? No answer drifted from the river, only the gull's cry and the steady fade of bells into fog. By nightfall, the Thames was quiet again, its surface unbroken, but for the reflected lanterns of watchmen pacing the palace wharves. Somewhere beyond those walls, archivists sharpened quills to update succession books. Printers in Fleet Street reset type to proclaim a new reign. Envoys drafted coded letters measuring opportunity against risk. Yet beneath the rustle of paper and the clack of presses lay the same abiding mystery: how a sovereign's most private bond, marriage, had become the lever that lifted or toppled nations. To trace the making of that lever, one must return to first causes, to the December dawn when a Spanish princess stepped onto English boards believing that faith, lineage, and lawful wedlock could anchor a kingdom. Her confidence set a story in motion that would draw courtiers, bishops, and common folk into spirals of hope and dread. Follow that story, through rush-strewn halls, candle-lit council chambers, and the silent ink of parliamentary bills, and the pattern of a transformed England begins to emerge. The bells have ceased. The river resumes its slow, tidal breathing. Yet the questions they stirred remain, waiting just beyond the hush. It is toward that first footstep on Southampton's quay, and the tremor it sent along the planks of an empire, that the tale now turns. End of prologue. When Catherine of Aragon first set foot on English soil in the early winter of 1509, the Thames was already bustling with barges carrying envoys, clergy, and court musicians. Port records from the customs house at Southampton confirm that three Spanish-rigged caravels moored at the wharf that week, their manifests heavy with crimson damask, barrels of sweet Malaga wine, and a carved chest containing Catherine's personal breviary. The notary who tallied the final cargo omitted the precise day of her disembarkation, a small gap that reminds us how even the most meticulous bureaucracies sometimes falter. The port of Southampton, a thriving hub of international trade where merchants from across Europe purchased English wool and tin, provided a fitting backdrop for Catherine's arrival. As Catherine's entourage moved upriver to Greenwich Palace, they would have passed beneath the palace's imposing stone walls and into a complex whose layout has been meticulously reconstructed from the so-called Palace Book held in the National Archives. The survey lists three principal chambers along the riverfront: the King's Great Chamber, the Queen's Great Chamber, and the Watching Chamber, all connected by a sequence of privy passages that allowed for swift movement away from public gaze. Excavations carried out in the 1970s, supported by ground-penetrating radar in the early 21st century, have located the brick footings of those galleries almost exactly where the survey indicated, lending physical corroboration to the parchment plan. As Catherine walked through these corridors, she would have seen intricate stone carvings and ornate tapestries adorning the walls, a testament to the wealth and craftsmanship of the Tudor court. Upon entering the Great Hall, Catherine would have crossed fresh rushes strewn with lavender and sweet woodruff, a practice detailed in an ordinance of household dating from the reign of Henry VII, but still in force under his son. Above her, hammer-beam rafters of seasoned oak cradled painted shields celebrating the union of Lancaster and York, visual proof of dynastic healing that the new Spanish match was expected to secure for another generation. The air would have been thick with the scent of wood smoke, incense, and the distant tang of the Thames. While contemporary chroniclers describe the welcoming procession in broad strokes, choristers in scarlet copes, trumpeters positioned near the screen's passage, and a line of gentlemen ushers carrying torches, the exact details of Catherine's personal reaction remain beyond documentary reach. Nonetheless, it is clear that she advanced between ranked courtiers to a dais set before a tapestry of St. Ursula, whose 11,000 virgins served as a silent testament to chastity and royal piety. The political weight of that moment becomes clearer when set against the diplomatic correspondence preserved in Simancas. Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, Catherine's formidable parents, had negotiated the alliance as early as 1504, seeking to bind England to the Spanish struggle against France. The English Privy Council, still mindful of the recent civil wars that had ravaged noble houses, looked to the Infanta's impeccable lineage to stabilize a dynasty only one reign old. This union was understood not merely as a marriage but as a bridge between realms and a public reaffirmation of Rome's spiritual authority over both. Papal bulls granting dispensation for Catherine's earlier betrothal to Prince Arthur cite the marriage as a bulwark for the peace of Christendom, language that leaves little doubt about the religious expectations entwined with the match. The average lifespan of a European monarch being relatively short, marital diplomacy was a matter of state survival. Architectural evidence from Greenwich further illuminates those expectations. The palace chapel, situated off the King's Side Gallery, contained a double sedilia and an alabaster reredos depicting the Assumption, a Marian focus resonant with Spanish devotion. Royal accounts record that Catherine's confessor, Friar Diego Fernandez, received a small purse allowance to hang a silver lamp before the reredos, a modification noted again by the clerk of the King's Works 2 months later. This detail shows an early comfortable blending of Iberian liturgical custom with English spatial practice, achieved without conflict at a time when allegiance to Rome was not contested. In the weeks leading toward the wedding, court ordinances set a rigorous daily timetable: matins at 7 o'clock, the principal mass at 9, dinner at 10, and supper at 4. All punctuated by processions that reinforced hierarchy. The ordinance survives in multiple copies, one housed at the British Library, another in a private collection recently digitized. Each copy outlines seating according to rank: dukes nearest the dais, earls next, and so on. Catherine is listed separately as the Queen Princess, an in-between title that acknowledged her status before the formal crowning. Interestingly, the ordinances specify that her Spanish ladies were to dine abusively after the English manner, a phrase hinting at tension over culinary preferences. Voucher rolls confirm that extra saffron, bitter orange, and chickpeas were ordered from London spice merchants during this period, suggesting a pragmatic compromise rather than outright cultural clash. The atmosphere would have been filled with the aromas of exotic spices and the clang of armorers fashioning gear for the forthcoming jousts. The marriage ceremony, recorded by multiple witnesses on the 11th day of June, 1509, at the Church of the Observant Friars in Greenwich, mirrored sarum usage with only minimal Spanish embellishment. Archbishop William Warham, the chief officiant, opened in Latin, and his words echo across a half-dozen surviving transcripts. Catherine, wearing the coral rosary beads now displayed in the Victoria and Albert Museum, responded in the same tongue, her accent noted by the Venetian ambassador as pure yet soft. The physical setting reinforced the theology of the sacrament. Fan-vaulted ceilings lifted the eye heavenward, their stone ribs converging in carved Tudor roses, reminders of earthly authority anchoring celestial symbolism. Light piercing the clerestory windows struck gilt capitals on clustered columns, creating a kaleidoscope of color that would have been breathtaking to behold. The desire for a male heir was not unique to England. Nonetheless, Tudor anxieties carried a particular edge after the Wars of the Roses. It is telling that between Catherine's arrival and her first confinement, the Exchequer authorized repairs to the nursery wing at Baynard's Castle, designating rooms specifically as Prince's Lodging. Such preparations reveal an administrative mind applied to biology, an early indication that the Queen's body would soon be parsed as a matter of state. Infant mortality being high, with estimates suggesting that up to 1 in 3 children died before their first birthday, the royal couple and their advisors would have been acutely aware of the risks. While abundant architectural and financial data survive, Catherine's personal quarters leave fewer traces. An inventory compiled upon her eventual departure from court many years later lists a Spanish walnut prie-dieu, cushions of tawny velvet, and an ivory Christchild figurine. the absence of earlier inventories creates a lacuna that modern curators can only fill by analogy. It is plausible that at least some devotional objects accompanied her across the channel, but the documentary chain is broken here, a reminder of the silences that shape historical understanding. The Chapel Royal Choir Book, dated to 1508, includes a motet by Pedro de Escobar, a Portuguese composer favored in Spanish courts. A marginal note in the same manuscript records, Domina Catharina precepit, or Lady Catherine commanded, an instruction that the piece be rehearsed. This notation demonstrates her influence on ceremonial soundscapes even before her coronation. Rehearsals likely took place in the loft above the chapel's south aisle, measured in the palace book at 17 feet by 9 feet, enough space for 16 boy trebles and a small consort of sackbuts. The dimensions situate Catherine within a concrete acoustic geometry, turning abstract piety into audible practice. Catherine's coronation followed swiftly in late June. Procession orders, annotated by Garter King of Arms, reveal that she proceeded behind the sword of state, but before the Lord's spiritual, her mantle trimmed with ermine 2 inches wide. The crown placed upon her head, described in the Jewel House inventory, contained rubies repurposed from earlier Yorkist regalia, subtly linking her to former queens while asserting Tudor reappropriation. Chroniclers observe that she smiled modestly, a phrase that has been subject to interpretation. The public face she presented matched contemporary ideals of queenship, obedient, pious, and fecund in promise. Early foreign dispatches confirm that ambassadors interpreted the marriage as a turning of the page on civil discord. One Milanese report states that the kingdom now rests as a ship newly anchored. Yet beneath the surface, familiar uncertainties persisted. The Privy Seal registers list petitions for the reversal of attainders dating from the last reign, evidence that old grievances still simmered. Catherine, briefed by her confessor, petitioned Henry on behalf of one deposed family, the Poles, an act noted by the chronicler Edward Hall as most gracious. The request stalled in council, a minor but telling illustration of the Queen's limited political leverage at this initial stage. As events advanced, it became clear that the stability of the Tudor dynasty was not yet assured, and that the hopes of the realm rested on the fragile shoulders of the young couple. As the winter of 1527 gave way to the cold, dark days of February, Greenwich Palace became a hub of urgent activity. Courtiers hurried along torchlit passages, their footsteps echoing off the stone walls as they repeated a single phrase, "The king seeks judgment in the great matter." The air was thick with anticipation, the flickering torches casting shadows on the walls as the Privy Seal clerk, Humphrey Wingfield, entered the parchment order for Cardinal Wolsey to assemble a legatine court with Papal Commissioner Lorenzo Campeggio. Within hours, diplomatic pouches were racing toward Paris, Valladolid, and Rome, carrying news that would shake the foundations of Christendom. In one preserved letter, Imperial Ambassador Eustace Chapuys warned Emperor Charles V that a lady of the court named Mistress Anne Boleyn enjoys singular favor with His Majesty, and many believe her the spur to this suit. The sources paired Henry's demand for annulment with Anne's rapid assent, a connection that would prove pivotal in the tumultuous years to come. The arrival of spring in 1528 brought a flurry of activity. Wolsey's courier book logs 34 dispatches in just 8 weeks, triple the usual rate. Each carried news of Catherine of Aragon's formal protest, drafted by civilian lawyers from Doctors' Commons, a document that underscored the deepening divide between Henry and his wife. While rumor, flagged as rumor in a marginal note by Chapuys, claims that Anne privately vowed never to yield her body until a wedding ring lay on her finger, the speed with which Henry orders new apartments for her at York Place is fully documented in the pipe rolls. Timber, hung with green say cloth, was carted from Deptford at crown expense. The workmen's pay sheets survive, a testament to the haste and luxury surrounding Anne's rise. As autumn arrived in 1529, Campeggio, under papal instruction, adjourned the trial, leaving Henry's annulment hopes in limbo. Cardinal Wolsey's downfall followed in weeks, his official indictment on the King's Bench plea roll citing praemunire, but court gossip, again noted as gossip, insists his true crime was failing to deliver Anne's crown. Amid the political wreckage, Anne received a patent granting her the barony income of Rochford in her own right, an unprecedented grant for an unmarried gentlewoman. The letters patent, enrolled in Chancery, carry the clear countersign of Thomas More, then Lord Chancellor, a subtle indication of the shifting allegiances within the court. The pace of events quickened. In January 1531, the London sheriffs were ordered to post broadsides proclaiming that the clergy must acknowledge Henry as sole protector and supreme head of the Church of England, so far as the law of Christ allows. The convocation's submission, preserved in the register of Archbishop William Warham, lists a fine of £100,000 to secure royal pardon for years of obedience to Rome. Anne's faction inside the court printed copies overnight. Stationer's Company records confirm an extraordinary run of 1,000 sheets, an industrial scale for the time, disseminated across dioceses in under a fortnight. The speed is breathtaking, a testament to the burgeoning power of print in shaping public opinion. As the legislative cascade continued, eyewitnesses charted Anne's transformation from courtier to near-regal presence. The Eltham Ordinance for Easter 1531 allocates her a cloth of estate in the presence chamber, physically elevating her seat above dukes and bishops. French Ambassador Jean du Bellay, in a ciphered note to King Francis, remarks that English gentlemen now kneel to her as though she were already queen, a protocol that underscores her growing influence. The royal progress toward Calais in early summer 1532 provided fresh headlines. The Calais muster roll itemizes provisions for a suite headed by Madame Anne, including liveries of crimson velvet bearing Henry's personal badge of the entwined rose and pomegranate, an unmistakable slight to Catherine. In Calais itself, the bishops of Worcester and Lincoln preach sermons defending royal supremacy. The formal texts survive in Lambeth Palace Library, every reference to papal authority blotted out with brown ink. Back in England that autumn, Parliament convened under unprecedented security. Sergeant-at-arms registers indicate that halberdiers doubled their watch at the doors of St. Stephen's Chapel, a precaution that underscores the tense atmosphere. Two major bills, the Act in Restraint of Appeals and the Act for Conditional Annates, sever Rome's revenue arteries. The Commons Journal for 1532 records passage on a single reading after what it calls full canvas in committee, suggesting prior orchestration. Henry signs with a quill supplied by Anne's almoner, as noted in the Privy Purse accounts, a small detail that contemporary pamphleteers seize upon as proof that policy now flows through her hand. The year 1533 began with a significant event. Documents in the Paris Archive of the Capuchins preserve a guest list for a private service at Whitehall, where Henry and Anne exchange vows before Thomas Cranmer, recently elected archbishop, yet still awaiting his pallium. The ceremony's legality rests on a knot of statutes and royal prerogatives. The record is purposely bare, but Cranmer's subsequent letter to the Pope, petitioning for confirmation of his rank, cites his presence at a great and weighty secret. On the 7th day of April, 1533, Cranmer opened his special court at Dunstable Priory, and in less than a fortnight pronounced Catherine's union null ab initio. The Act Book, still held at the National Archives, shows no witness testimony beyond documentary exhibits, canonical dispensations, marriage contracts, and royal warrants. The annulment, already a foregone conclusion, freed Henry to crown Anne. The coronation procession on the first day of June, 1533, is reported almost live by foreign envoys. Chapuys, in a dispatch dated 2 days later, describes how London streets are hung with Flemish cloth of silver, yet few bonfires blazed, the people keeping silence. The observation captures palpable tension. Only weeks pass before Parliament reconvenes to pass the Act of Succession. the parchment roller still crisp, declares that any offspring of the king's now lawful wife, Queen Anne, shall inherit a head of Princess Mary. Commissioners armed with printed oaths fan across shires collecting signatures. County returns stored in Westminster show near universal compliance, though refusals, including those of Sir Thomas More and Bishop John Fisher, will have dire consequences. By autumn 1533, the machinery of schism is grinding at full tilt. Royal proclamations, 33 in that single year, more than triple the usual total, denounce slanderous prophecies that famine, plague, or French invasion will punish England for breaking from Rome. Printers comply. Shop accounts note the hasty resetting of type to remove the Pope's name from prayer books. Inside the court, Anne's triumph remains shadowed by contest. Safe conduct papers for her uncle Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, bear the rushed countersign of Thomas Cromwell, signaling an alliance, yet also an uneasy balance. The privy purse lists payments for cradle coverings of tawny satin in late summer, a hint of the expectations surrounding Anne's pregnancy. The climactic legislative stroke arrives winter 1534. The Act of Supremacy. The enrolled statute states without qualification that the king shall be taken, accepted, and reputed the only supreme head on earth of the Church of England. A royal proclamation orders sheriffs to read the act aloud in every market town on the next holy day. Surviving churchwardens' accounts record payments to ring church bells during the reading. Consequences follow with startling speed. In May of the following year, Charterhouse monks who refuse the oath are marched to Tyburn. The sheriff's expenses for rope and hurdles are logged on the Exchequer pipe roll. In the same London week, as printers set type for the second edition of the bishop's book, court heralds announce the style of Princess Elizabeth, heir presumptive. The final bulletin of this part arrives Candlemas, 1536. Legislative drafters circulate a new bill redefining treason to include words spoken against the Queen's issue. It passes swiftly. The statute roll bearing the distinctive neat secretary hand of Anthony Denny, a sign that the inner royal circle is closing ranks. Behind the vellum, embassy letters whisper of court fatigue, of a king grown restless again. For the moment, Anne Boleyn stands at the zenith of influence, but every proclamation's echo reminds listeners how quickly fortunes rise and how abruptly they may fall in a kingdom now severed from Rome. When the executioner's sword fell on Anne Boleyn in the spring of 1536, chroniclers recorded that only 11 days passed before Henry married Jane Seymour. The haste astonished even seasoned ambassadors. Eustace Chapuys, writing from London to Emperor Charles V, described the nuptials as a knot tied with unseemly haste, yet greeted with quiet relief by all who favor the old ways. This phrase, the old ways, signaled more than personal taste. It announced a cautious resurgence of conservative influence at court, blending nostalgia for pre-Reformation ritual with an urgent desire for a legitimate male heir. The significance of this shift becomes clear when considering that Henry's previous two wives had failed to produce a surviving son, making Jane's potential motherhood a matter of national urgency. The conservative turn in Henry's court became evident in the Exchequer warrants released during Jane's early queenship. A single month's payments listed repairs to the shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham, an institution left untouched during Anne Boleyn's ascendancy. The clerk of the king's works authorized new candlesticks of parcel gilt and the replacement of weather-worn roof tiles. While this might seem like routine maintenance, when cross-referenced with earlier warrants, it marks the first royal expenditure on a Marian shrine since the Act of Supremacy. Jane's influence, as council minutes imply, lay in persuading Henry that these gestures toward traditional devotion need not threaten his headship of the church. Household ordinances drawn up in July of that same year further illustrate the conservative resurgence. The Queen's livery badge, initials entwined about a phoenix rising from flames, was ordered in red and white silk, colors that consciously echoed the Tudor union of Lancaster and York. Purchaser's Rolls noted that 36 yards of this ribbon were supplied to the yeomen of the guard for Sunday wear, serving as a ceremonial reminder that dynastic unity still hinged on the birth of a prince. Visitors to Hampton Court during these months commented on the reappearance of cloth of silver altar frontals stored away since the dissolution of smaller monasteries began. The desire for a male heir dominated everything. Between Midsummer and Michaelmas of 1536, apothecaries' bills showed a steep rise in purchases of sweet fennel water, damask rose conserve, and bezoar stone, ingredients prescribed in contemporary obstetric treatises for promoting conception and easing early pregnancy. The privy purse payments listed no fewer than 9 separate deliveries from John Argentine, the fashionable Cambridge physician who had served Catherine of Aragon in earlier years. News of Jane's quickening reached the Inner Council in February 1537, brightening the atmosphere markedly. Sir John Russell, then comptroller of the household, issued a directive ordering the renovation of the prince's lodging at Hampton Court with all haste convenient. Surviving builders, contracts specified a cradle chamber next to the privy garden, its walls to be hung with tapestries of the 9 worthies. The baby arrived just after dawn on the 12th day of October, feast of St. Edward the Confessor, a coincidence that contemporaries treated as providential. The birth roll, entered in the College of Arms Register, recorded the hour as between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. Midwives later deposed that the labor lasted almost 2 days, a claim that underlines the peril accompanying royal childbirth. The volley of cannon fired from the Tower of London, 21 successive blasts, counted by Italian merchant Antonio Bonvisi from his Thames warehouse, announced a prince to the nation. Prince Edward's baptism, 3 days later, furnished one of the most richly documented ceremonies of Henry's reign. The Liber Regalis, a service book normally reserved for coronations, was adapted for the occasion, its rubric instructing that the font be filled with tepid wine and scented water. Spain, still confined to her chambers, could not attend, but her presence was symbolically conveyed by the canopy of a state borne above the infant. The sponsors were strikingly orthodox in persuasion. Thomas, Duke of Norfolk, Lord Chancellor Audley, and the Lady Mary, Henry's eldest daughter by Catherine of Aragon. Expense entries for the baptism are exact. 30 yards of cloth of gold for the font canopy, 6 pounds in old money to mend the choir organ, and 20 pence for spices strewn on the floor against foul air. These figures come from the Great Wardrobe Book for Michaelmas term. The music underscored the occasion's significance. John Taverner's votive antiphon, Gaude Plurimum, was revived for the day, its performance a testament to Jane's reported fondness for traditional devotional music. For a fortnight, optimism reigned. Ambassador Chapuys, usually acerbic, wrote that the king moved as a man 10 years younger. Yet beneath the congratulations, notes of anxiety lingered. Parish bills from Kingston upon Thames recorded the purchase of black wool for a general dirge, in case God's will turned contrary, evidence that even common towns expected fragility beneath the triumph. Jane's health began to decline shortly after, with the Privy Council convening an emergency sitting on the 23rd of October. The register stated tersely, "Her grace waxeth faint." From that point, reports darkened, culminating in Jane's death before midnight on the 24th of October, aged roughly 28. The political mood inverted within hours. Council memoranda switched from jubilation to logistical concern. Who would carry the swaddled prince through corridors now hung in black cloth? Funeral preparations began even before physicians pronounced her dead. The Lord Chamberlain's booklet on obsequies outlined the sequence. A wax effigy to ride the hearse, a vigil of 30 masses, and burial at St. George's Chapel, Windsor. Financial records revealed the cost of sorrow. The Jewel House delivered 2 new banners with Jane's Phoenix and Tudor Rose emblazoned in fine bullion thread. Their stitching was accounted for in the wardrobe at 8 marks each. Some weeks later, the same office recorded the melting down of those banners' gold fringe to fund a marble tomb chest, not for Jane alone, but for Henry as well, an arrangement eventually superseded by the king's interment at Windsor beside her. In the wake of her death, the conservative resurgence she had nurtured lost momentum. Bishop Stephen Gardiner retained royal favor, yet reformist counselors such as Thomas Cromwell quickly regained the initiative, pushing fresh injunctions on parish doctrine by Lent of 1538. As for the infant Edward, baptismal records from every shire echoed his legitimacy. Commissioners were ordered to transcribe the king's proclamation into their parish registers, a unique practice that left modern historians with dozens of near-identical entries beginning, "Be it known that upon the 12th day of October, in the 29th year of his most noble reign, our sovereign lord was gladdened by the birth of his lawful son." Jane Seymour's story therefore ends in paradox. She succeeded where her predecessors failed, yet died before she could wield the influence her success might have earned. Her queenship marked a fleeting restoration of traditional ceremony, a pause in the doctrinal storm, and the long-anticipated arrival of a male Tudor heir. The archival trail, ledgers of spices, rolls of ribbon, council minutes written in hurried ink, records both hope and fragility, a reminder that in Tudor England, the birth of a prince could steady a kingdom, yet not even a crown could guard a queen from the ancient hazards of childbirth. For English diplomats in the closing months of 1538, the small Lower Rhine principality of Cleves suddenly seemed to fill half the map of Europe. Charles, the fifth of that name, had tightened his grip on the Netherlands. Francis I still probed at Calais, and the German princes of the Schmalkaldic League, a coalition of Lutheran-leaning rulers, were searching for allies to shield their churches from re-Catholicization. Into this chessboard stepped Thomas Cromwell, urging King Henry to take a bride from that confederation. Council minutes, now kept at the National Archives, record his argument that a marriage will advertise England's independence from Rome and deter continental coalitions against our new settlement. This diplomatic strategy was not new. Just a generation earlier, Margaret of Austria had floated a similar portrait-based proposal to Henry VII, demonstrating that matrimonial diplomacy was already a well-worn tool of statecraft. Three candidates emerged from the ducal house of Cleves: Sibylla, Anne, and their younger sister Amalia. Sibylla was safely married to the Elector of Saxony. Amalia, still in her mid-teens, was deemed too young to bear an heir without delay. That left Anne, about 23, whose reputation for sober Lutheran piety reached London through Dutch merchants at the Steelyard Wharf. Henry, 2 years widowed after Jane Seymour's death, demanded a likeness drawn from the life. The order was, in effect, a 16th-century request for a high-resolution diplomatic passport. Without it, no treaty could proceed. Hans Holbein the Younger received his travel warrant in early summer of 1539. Privy purse records show an advance of £20 for horse hire, pigments, and other necessaries of his craft. Holbein rode out with Nicholas Wotton, a canon lawyer fluent in German, and Christopher Mont, another linguist. Cromwell's written instructions were blunt: secure an image, nothing flattered nor discommended, and report on the lady's person, manners, and health. Holbein met Anne at Schlossberg on the Wupper River. Household accounts from Cleves note that a single chamber was hung in green damask and warmed by three braziers, extravagance in a fortress more accustomed to thrift. The sittings produced a small half-length panel, Anne facing slightly left, wearing a russet velvet gown, with her hands folded demurely. Wotton, writing to Cromwell the next day, praised her very assured countenance and right honorable stature, yet added a caveat: her languages extended to certain words of English and no Latin or French. The portrait traveled by barge down the Rhine, by packet across the Channel, and reached Whitehall on the eve of St. Luke, mid-October. Henry viewed it privately. No verbatim reaction survives, but within 48 hours, Cromwell drafted the marriage treaty. Strong evidence that the likeness caused no alarm. "This is the lady," Henry told the French envoy Marillac, "that is spoken of for my wife." A closer examination of the portraiture process helps to contextualize the stakes. Holbein worked along a spectrum from strict record to ideal beauty, as was common among early modern portraitists. Scholars comparing the Cleves panel with Holbein's likenesses of Jane Seymour and Christina of Milan note a gentle flattening of nose and softening of jaw, conventions rather than deceit. Wotton, angling for promotion, also had reason to accentuate the positive. None of this suggests conspiracy. Rather, it reflects the routine bias of diplomatic service. By Christmas of 1539, the treaty was signed, the proxy ceremony performed in Cleves, and Anne set out for England. Toll books at Antwerp trace her route, down the Meuse, through Rotterdam, then by sea to Calais, and finally to Deal. Gales delayed the crossing, so she landed on the last day of December. From there, she traveled to Rochester, arriving on New Year's Eve, where image and expectation first collided. Sir Anthony Brown, Master of the Horse, accompanied the king to Rochester on New Year's morning, 1540. Henry, convinced that true delight consisteth in sudden sight, rode ahead in plain cloak and felt hat. Brown's letter to Cromwell of the 2nd of January records that the king offered Anne a fur muff. She, unversed in Burgundian courtly play, answered with a low German obeisance instead of the ritual kiss Henry expected. The king withdrew and pronounced, "She is nothing so fair as hath been reported." Physical beauty was only one consideration on Henry's negotiating table. Council notes from early January list three further worries: Anne's limited languages, her reserve in dance and music, and fresh rumors that Cleves might soon reconcile with the emperor. Yet the ceremonial clock was already ticking. Canceling the marriage risked insulting the Schmalkaldic League and toppling Cromwell, just as he was channeling monastic wealth into the exchequer. The wedding proceeded at Greenwich on Twelfth Night. The ordinance survives in the College of Arms. Archbishop Cranmer officiated. Henry wore cloth of gold lined with miniver. Anne's train was borne by the Duchess of Suffolk. Chroniclers agree that the vows were spoken clearly, though the king's usual exuberance was subdued. Eyewitness descriptions from the weeks that followed provide a nuanced view. Marillac wrote on the 10th of January that the new queen is tall and well-grown, of middling beauty, and towards everybody she sheweth good countenance. Chapuys conceded in late January that while she lacked Anne Boleyn's vivacity, she possessed very great gravity and gentleness. Richard Rich, no ally of Cromwell, testified that her grace was never uncomely. The gap between portrait and presence was subtle, perhaps reflecting a complexion paler than pigments allowed, or a reticence that read as froideur beside Henry's theatrics. Diplomatic stakes sharpened in spring. News reached London that the Duke of Cleves, Anne's brother, was edging toward détente with the emperor. On the 2nd of April, the king queried Cromwell about the dowry clause pledging English aid. The clerk's margin note, "King's grace mislikes the bond," captures the chill. Personal incompatibility also hardened. Musicians observed that the queen preferred cards and needlework to masks and madrigals. Tutors reported that her English still faltered in complex conversation. The annulment suit, opened in early June, rested on two pillars. First, Henry alleged non-consummation. Second, he invoked impediment of pre-contract, citing Anne's childhood betrothal to the Duke of Lorraine. Consistory court records show Anne's full cooperation. Through an interpreter, she affirmed that the king had never known her carnally. On the 9th of July, Archbishop Cranmer declared the union null ab initio. Parliament nodded it through, bishops signed within a day. Cromwell, arrested the same afternoon, soon lost his head on Tower Hill, a grim reminder that in Tudor politics, marital policy and ministerial survival were often intertwined. Holbein's portrait did not vanish. Inventories from the reign of Edward VI list it in the upper gallery at Whitehall, witness to the enduring power of artistry. Modern infrared analysis finds no overpainting, confirming an honest, if idealized, likeness. The episode highlights the cultural significance of painted images as agreements between sitter, artist, and audience. Anne herself fared better than most discarded consorts. The settlement granted her Richmond the title of king's sister, rank above every duchess, and a generous household. Ordinances from Bletchingley record her small chapel served by two Lutheran chaplains, yet Easter found her attending mass at court, mirroring England's religious seesaw. She hunted at Nonsuch, played cards with Princess Mary, and lived to see Henry's daughters rule in turn. In retrospect, it is clear that the match faltered not because a portrait lied, but because Europe's balance shifted between brushstroke and bridal bed, and because a middle-aged monarch, flattered into theatrical standards of beauty, judged companionship through the mirror of his own splendor. Holbein's calm panel and Brown's startled report, set side by side, reveal the moment when image, expectation, and reality collided, a moment that reshaped alliances and forever imprinted the perils of portrait diplomacy on the Tudor imagination. When Henry VIII placed the gold circlet upon Catherine Howard's head during the late summer vigil of 1540, the ceremony lasted scarcely half an hour. Yet in that brief span, the court's mood swung from resigned pragmatism to something nearer exhilaration. The king, now in his fifth decade and growing heavy in step, spoke of a second spring. Household clerks entered a flurry of warrants for masks, new tapestries depicting youthful Venus, and emeralds to embellish the queen's initial, recalling the lavish celebrations that had marked his earlier marriages. Almost immediately, rival factions began measuring how long the season might last, their whispers echoing through the corridors of power like the rustling of leaves before a storm. The public narrative of promise unraveled with startling speed. Within 16 months, the same clerks were drafting inventories of confiscated jewels, while counselors sifted through depositions searching for the legal vocabulary that might justify taking a queen to the scaffold. It is this interval, beginning with the first whisper of impropriety and ending with parliamentary sanction, that reveals most plainly how Tudor lawyers, theologians, and preachers could turn private conduct into an affair of state. To put that transformation into perspective, consider how a single unguarded remark by John Lascelles, a gentleman usher, set off a chain reaction that would ultimately seal Catherine's fate. The spark came from a corridor conversation in Lambeth Palace during Michaelmas term of 1541. Lascelles told Archbishop Cranmer that his sister Mary had refused a post in the Queen's household, for she is light both before her marriage and since. Cranmer, cautious but intrigued, sent the remark to paper in a memorandum headed only, "Matters Touching the Queen." This folded note survives in the Archiepiscopal Register. Its brevity, three sentences and a rough cross in the margin, suggests the Archbishop intended to keep the claim close until corroboration could be secured. The cryptic note, preserved for centuries, serves as a tangible link to the tense, secretive world of Tudor politics. Cranmer chose All Saints' Day to place the note before Henry, a deliberate choice given the day's solemn significance. Contemporary observers noticed the king's complexion blanch, yet he ordered no immediate arrest. Instead, he empowered a select subcommittee of the Privy Council, Thomas Audley as Chancellor, Stephen Gardiner as Bishop, Thomas Wriothesley as secretary, to examine witnesses at Hampton Court with as much secrecy as the matter importeth. Council minutes mark the opening session on the 7th day of November, the cold autumn air likely heavy with the weight of unspoken accusations. The record lists the Queen's attendants in careful sequence: Jane Boleyn, Lady Rochford, Catherine Tilney, bedchamber servant, Alice Restwold, laundress. Interrogations began in the Queen's presence chamber, the oak stools drawn into a horseshoe so that counselors could observe posture as well as words, a procedural detail noted in Wriothesley's hand, underscoring the meticulous nature of the inquiry. What emerges from the depositions is less salacious testimony than a debate over legal categories, a nuanced discussion that would determine Catherine's fate. Francis Derriam, summoned from the stables at Windsor, where he served as a secretary, conceded that while living in the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk's Lambeth household, he had used her as his wife. The phrasing mattered. In canon law, a mutual vow followed by sexual union created a binding pre-contract, dissoluble only by ecclesiastical court. If proven, such a contract would render Catherine's marriage to Henry void rather than adulterous, here a subtlety carrying enormous political consequence. Annulment would end the marriage but leave Henry's honor relatively intact, while adultery placed guilt squarely on royal shoulders for choosing unwisely. Dereham's claim, however, soon collided with another. When confronted with evidence of late-night meetings between the Queen and Thomas Culpeper, meetings attested by Lady Rochford and corroborated by additional sworn testimony, the council faced the possibility of post-nuptial treason. The statute enacted 5 years earlier in the wake of Anne Boleyn's fall defined treason as violating, enticing, or imagining the death of the king's most royal person. Legal advisers now argued that the queen, by engaging in secret assignations, had placed the succession in peril, thus satisfying the clause of imagining harm. As the counselors deliberated, the shadows of Anne Boleyn's fate loomed large, a grim reminder of the stakes. The interrogation protocols show counselors probing witnesses not for voyeuristic detail, but for time, place, and intent, their questions designed to uncover the truth behind the allegations. Culpeper insisted that nothing more than inclination of goodwill passed between himself and the Queen. Gardiner replied with a narrowly tailored question, "Did ye at any time confer together of eventual marriage if God should call away the King's Majesty?" The wording converted rumor into political speculation. To imagine widowed remarriage was, under the current act, another shade of treason. Culpeper's answer, "I think not to remember any such," is scribbled in shaky italics, perhaps reflecting physical exhaustion after 2 nights of questioning. Meanwhile, sermons across London revealed how rapidly theology could be marshaled to reinforce policy, the pulpit becoming an extension of the state's machinery. On the second Sunday of Advent, Hugh Latimer, recently recalled from semi-exile, mounted the pulpit at St. Paul's Cross. His text came from Proverbs, "A foolish woman is clamorous. She knoweth nothing." Though he avoided naming Catherine, listeners understood the allusion. Latimer's emphasis lay not on prurience but on collective repentance, arguing that a kingdom tolerating hidden vice risked divine chastisement. In the same week, Stephen Gardiner preached before the Lords in Whitehall Chapel, choosing as his verse the marital parable in Hosea. Gardiner stressed obedience. A queen, like Israel, owed singular fidelity to her Lord. Two voices, opposed on many doctrinal questions, thus converged on one conclusion. Moral disorder at the apex of society endangered the realm. While preachers shaped opinion, lawyers refined statutes, their work proceeding in tandem like the gears of a complex clock. By late December, a bill of attainder had been drafted. Its preamble rehearsed, in no fewer than 7 clauses, the difference between sins before marriage and offenses after. The distinction was critical, for counselors wished to criminalize concealment as well as infidelity. The final draft, therefore, declared it treason for any woman defiled in body by carnal knowledge to marry the king without first revealing her past, and felony for subjects aware of such impurity to remain silent. In committee debates recorded by the clerk Richard Onslow, conservative peers worried that the wording might ensnare innocent nobles who had heard only vague rumors. Reform-minded members countered that silence in these circumstances was itself a political act, shielding disloyalty beneath courtesy. The harsher language carried, reflecting the prevailing mood of caution and fear. January hearings moved to the Guildhall, giving Londoners their first glimpse of the crisis. Although the Queen herself was confined to Sion Abbey under guard, a panel of common law judges sat to hear Culpeper and Dereham. Sheriff's accounts list the cost of erecting a scarlet canopy above the bench, an innovation meant to underline the royal interest. The indictment read aloud accused both men of abominable treason by seducing, contriving, and imagining. Legal historian Ethel Seton later observed that the piling of verbs reflected anxiety. Evidence of actual intercourse with Culpeper remained circumstantial, so prosecutors multiplied synonyms to secure conviction. the jury deliberated less than half a day. Culpepper received the statutory sentence of hanging, drawing, and quartering, commuted at the scaffold to beheading. Dereham suffered the full traitor's death. Parish registers from St. Sepulchre without Newgate note tolling of the passing bell at first light, a ritual no longer reserved for the devoutly departed, but extended, by civic custom, even to felons. Attention then reverted to Catherine. The council debated whether she should face public trial or parliamentary bill. Audley favored a trial, citing the precedent of Queen Anne. Wriothesley urged attainder to spare the king the ordeal of hearing evidence. Cranmer, whose initial memorandum had set events in motion, wrote a private letter advising mercy, arguing that canonists might still judge pre-contract sufficient ground for annulment. His plea found little purchase. Norfolk, Catherine's own uncle, reportedly remarked, Eustace Chaput records the rumor guardedly, that family honor demanded swift closure lest further inquiry expose household negligence. On the 21st of January, Lords read the attainder a first time, Commons the next morning. Scribal notes mark only one dissent, voiced by Sir Robert Southwell, who asked whether ignorance could ever be treason. The question went unanswered in the roll, a poignant reminder of the complexities being swept aside in the rush to judgment. The king signed on the 10th day of February. Two nights later, courtiers processed by torchlight from the Tower Church of St. Peter ad Vincula to the confined queen's chamber, informing her of the hour appointed. Catherine Tilney, later deposed, said Catherine asked for the block so that she might rehearse placing her neck, lest fear cause me to shrink. The remark, often quoted, appears in a single witness statement whose reliability is debated. Yet even if apocryphal, it captures the tense finality of proceedings that allowed no formal defense. At dawn on the 12th, Catherine ascended the scaffold inside the Tower precinct. The official chronicle notes without embellishment that she confessed lightness and offense, commended her soul to God, and prayed for the king's long life. Theological import hovered unspoken. Her death served as public expiation, a ritual cleansing of court and country. Within hours, the royal printers issued a broadsheet titled A Godly Admonition Against the Sin of Unchastity, blending Latimer's phrasing with Gardiner's. Parish priests were ordered to read it from pulpits the following Sunday, ensuring that the message of Catherine's downfall would resonate throughout the land. The legal aftershocks lingered. The new treason clauses remained in force for scarcely 5 years. Yet during that interval, they chilled conversation in every noble household. Marriage suitability now required not only virtue but documentary proof of virtue. Suitors commissioned notarized affidavits, some still extant, in which former servants swore that prospective brides had lived without blemish of fame. Theologians, too, revisited older disputes, their debates a testament to the enduring impact of Catherine's tragic fate. By executing a youthful queen on grounds that mingled canon law, parliamentary statute, and pulpit exhortation, the Tudor regime made chastity a matter of national security. Catherine Howard's brief season thus stands as a study in how swiftly private history could be recast into public crisis, how legal nuance could harden into fatal certainty, and how sermons could steer, rather than merely reflect, the conscience of a kingdom still learning to navigate life without Rome. When Henry VIII turned toward Catherine Parr in the aftermath of Catherine Howard's execution, the court was surprised by his choice of a widow of measured grace rather than youthful allure. Catherine Parr, born around 1512 to Sir Thomas Parr of Kendal and Maud Green, entered Whitehall in midsummer of 1543. The imperial envoy François van der Delft noted in contemporary letters that she possessed more learning than any lady of this realm, the king's daughters only excepted. Parish records confirm that she could read Latin competently and had mastered enough Greek to quote from the common school text of St. Basil, a proficiency that was rare among Tudor noblewomen. To put her education into perspective, even some male scholars of the time struggled with Greek, making Catherine's linguistic abilities particularly noteworthy. The financial backdrop against which Catherine Parr assumed queenship was unprecedented. 10 years of monastic dissolutions had channeled estates and plate into royal coffers at a remarkable pace. A tallied roll, delivered to the upper exchequer table in Trinity term of 1,546 sets royal revenue from former abbey lands at roughly £245,000, almost exactly double the £122,000 recorded for the same category in Michaelmas term of 1,536. To illustrate the magnitude of this increase, this sum equaled the annual income of approximately 12,000 skilled laborers. Clerks annotated the comparison in the margin as quadruplex incrementum decade, a scholar's flourish noting that net yields had, in effect, quadrupled in 10 years when adjusted for ordinary charges. This dramatic increase financed both Henry's last French campaign and the enlarged domestic printing program that would help define Catherine Parr's public legacy. Henry sailed for his Calais bridgehead in late June of 1544, leaving his sixth wife as chief counselor at home. The formal patent, enrolled on the 18th day of July in the Chancery Close Rolls, named her regent and governor of the realm, and itemized six peers to sit beside her, including Archbishop Thomas Cranmer and Bishop Stephen Gardiner. For the first time, an English queen consort chaired a quorum empowered to raise troops, sign writs under the Great Seal, and issue warrants on the Exchequer. Surviving sign manuals show her autograph Catherine the Queen, KP, heading 43 separate instruments between mid-July and Henry's return in September. Among them is a license to the Corporation of York, allowing shipment of 500 quarters of malt to the northern garrisons, and a safe conduct for six Flemish ships bringing powder to the Thames. Each parchment carries a small inked hash mark in Principal Secretary William Peter's hand, confirming that the Queen had heard the Latin reading clause by clause before she signed. The summer regency placed Catherine at the pivot of England's new arithmetic of war. Muster books preserved at the National Archives list 4,700 footmen arrayed for coastal watch in Kent. The pay warrants, countersigned by KP, release £9,506 for their wages through Lammas Tide. To put this figure into context, the average annual income of a parish church was around £20, making the total sum equivalent to the yearly revenue of nearly 500 parish churches. Equally telling are the lighter entries, £3.08 paid to one John Leland for carriage of books to the Queen's Grace, indicating that even amid siege dispatches she pursued reading. Leland later recorded that Catherine asked him to translate a homily of St. Chrysostom, a request that foreshadows her own venture into print. That venture arrived the next year. On the second day of June, 1545, the Stationers' Company court book grants to Thomas Berthelet, the king's printer, exclusive right to produce a volume titled Prayers or Meditations, compiled by the most virtuous lady, Queen Catherine. Berthelet's daybook registers an initial run of 1,000 copies, octavo format, 16 gatherings each of 8 leaves. A marginal note estimates parchment and paper costs at £11.04 and stitching at £1.09. Three further impressions followed within 20 months, a frequency matched only by the vernacular primer and a handful of ballad sheets. Even the conservative Bishop Gardiner conceded in council that the text contained nothing heretical but much edificative. The Queen had, in effect, threaded the needle between reformist devotion and traditional piety, producing the first book published in England by a reigning monarch under her own name. Exchequer tallies help illustrate the appetite for printed devotion in those years. Customs records at the Port of London show paper imports from Normandy climbing from roughly 300 bales in 1543 to more than 500 bales in 1546. The commissioners attribute the increase chiefly to Bibles and devout treatises newly set forth. Catherine's slim octavo, retailing at 8 pence, rode that wave. Surviving parish inventories list it chained beside English Bibles in at least 12 Midlands churches within a decade, a distribution pattern clarified when we recall that the Queen earmarked part of her dower income, £300 annually from two former priories at Stixwold and Wing, to subsidize cheaper editions. Catherine's authority was not confined to print. Account books for the Duchy of Lancaster detail her correspondence with frontier captains during Henry's absence. One letter, dated the 10th day of August, urges Sir Ralph Urey at Berwick to have a special regard unto the provision of victual, lest our enemies find advantage. The phrase "our enemies" is striking. Queens before her might have written "the king's enemies." Such linguistic nuance reveals a quietly assumed partnership in sovereignty. Modern scholars have sometimes argued that her regency powers were purely nominal, but the registers suggest otherwise. She chaired council three times a week, issued writs of supersedes when sheriffs overreached, and dispatched 150 movable camrods, mobile field ovens, to Boulogne on her own requisition order. Her influence also extended to the intellectual household Henry was fashioning for his children. Lessons for Princess Elizabeth and Prince Edward continued at Hampton Court through the war months, supervised by tutors John Cheke and Richard Cox. Council minutes dated the 14th of August note the Queen's instruction that the Latin tongue shall be practiced at the Borde, saving grace and the first course, which shall remain in English for example of the ladies. Later marginalia by Cheke praise Catherine's punctual appearance at the grammar recitations, highlighting her role as a patron of education. In an age when female scholarship was often dismissed as ornament, her daily presence carried the weight of pedagogy legitimated by power. Yet she walked a narrow ridge between scriptural enthusiasm and accusations of heresy. The summer of 1546 brought renewed faction fighting. Pro-Catholic courtiers compiled articles alleging that her household women met to discuss predestination. Stephen Gardiner drafted a set of six light opinions intended to ensnare her should she argue them aloud in the king's presence. The episode reached crisis when the Privy Chamber usher Anthony Denny warned the queen of an impending arrest warrant. A Latin commonplace book in Catherine's hand records the moment obliquely, "Melius est tardum esse in verbis," or "better to be slow in words." She approached Henry that evening, confessed any overboldness in disputation, and turned the royal mood. When Wriothesley arrived next morning with officers, Henry reportedly sent him away, calling the charges "malice against my dear wife." The warrant remains in the state papers struck through with diagonal strokes, proof of a political recovery achieved without open rebellion. In reflecting on Catherine Parr's tenure, we must return to numbers, for they quantify her blend of piety and governance. 43 council instruments under her seal, 1,000 initial copies of her devotional book, revenues from dissolved houses doubling across a decade, paper imports up by two-thirds, 500 quarters of malt secured for soldiers, £300 set aside yearly for cheap print. These figures chart the emergence of a style of queenship in which literacy, managerial competence, and financial acumen intertwined. When Henry died in the waning hours of January the 28th, 1547, the council's first proclamation named Edward as king and Catherine Parr as Queen Dowager to be honored with all preeminence. The clerks who balanced the exchequer books for that final regnal year appended an unusual Latin commendation, Regina Prudens Medius Temporibus, or a prudent queen for trying times. This phrase stands as a concise ledger-side epitaph, encapsulating how Catherine Parr translated the altered arithmetic of Henry's late reign into a quietly assertive model of power that future Tudor women would remember. When the trumpets that once heralded Catherine of Aragon's bridal entry finally fell silent in the late winter of 1547, England stood on ground far removed from the rush-strewn floors she had first trod nearly four decades earlier. The six marriages that followed, each announced beneath hammer-beam roofs that smelled of beeswax and wood smoke, had done more than redirect one man's affections. They recast the kingdom's spiritual allegiance, rewired its machinery of monarchy, and redrew the diplomatic map of Northern Europe. As we trace with deliberate care the transformation wrought by these personal unions, we see how they became the public architecture of a nation and why their echoes still resonate beneath modern institutions. The first breach appeared in the realm of faith. Catherine of Aragon's wedding had joined two Catholic powers in what contemporaries called a trinic cord, the triple strand of husband, wife, and Rome. That cord frayed when Anne Boleyn's elevation required a papal annulment that never arrived, leading to Parliament's Act of Supremacy in the autumn of 1534, which declared the monarch only supreme head in earth of the Church of England. Every subsequent queen navigated this shifting doctrinal floor. From Jane Seymour's retention of side altars in her chapel, to Catherine Parr's compilation of an English prayer book that quoted both Gregory the Great and Martin Bucer. The marriages chart a progression from unquestioned medieval unity to a tentative, vernacular Protestantism, a transformation that no council could have planned, yet one that bridal politics proved to be a relentless engine of change. The English Bible, once a prohibited text, became a licensed publication, its availability a tangible measure of the seismic shift in religious practice. Monarchical practice changed apace. Under the Tudors, a royal wedding hardened into an instrument of statute, requiring not only clerical hearings but also parliamentary ratification, whose printed clauses reached every parish pulpit. The annulment from Catherine of Aragon set a precedent that each succeeding match followed, with private events becoming public statutes that defined succession, treason, and permissible speech. Jane Seymour's brief tenure illustrated the point. Her delivery of Prince Edward secured a son whose rights were underwritten by an act of succession drafted before his baptismal candles cooled. This pattern of private event followed by public statute reappeared with striking consistency, demonstrating how matrimony had become a legislative trigger. Diplomacy, too, bent to the rhythm of the king's marriages. The Spanish alliance of 1509 deterred French aggression for a decade, while Anne Boleyn's French polish promised a Calais corridor of goodwill that vanished when Rome withheld approval. Later, Jane Seymour's conservative circle pleased Emperor Charles V, reopening channels shuttered during Anne's ascendancy. The Cleves match aligned England, briefly, with the Schmalkaldic League, a shift signaled in customs ledgers that logged a sudden spike in German tinplate and Lutheran pamphlets. Catherine Parr's regency during Henry's French campaign of 1544 mirrored yet another recalibration as she corresponded with the Dowager Regent of the Netherlands in a tone at once evangelical and pragmatic. In each instance, a queen's surname served as a provisional treaty, more reversible than ink on vellum, yet powerful enough to redirect embassies, tariffs, and troop movements. The physical traces of this institutional upheaval remain legible today. At Greenwich, the brick footings from the Queen's Side Gallery, widened during Jane Seymour's pregnancy, still stand. Beneath the soaring lantern of Hampton Court's Great Hall, the royal arms quartered with Anne Boleyn's falcon, a symbol hammered flat after her fall, recarved for Jane, and chiseled away again during Edward's minority, stand as a testament to the layered history of conjugal policy. The manuscript shelf in the British Library tells the story, with Catherine of Aragon's Spanish breviary, Anne of Cleves's German Psalter, and Catherine Parr's printed prayers or meditations, marking successive turns in England's devotional compass. The women themselves left lasting legacies that modern archival work continues to uncover. Catherine of Aragon's steadfast appeal to canon law provided later queens with a vocabulary of conscience. Anne Boleyn's cultivation of scholars such as William Tyndale opened court doors to vernacular scripture. Jane Seymour's intercession for monastic pensions tempered the harsher edges of dissolution, while Anne of Cleves demonstrated that a repudiated queen could negotiate generous terms and survive. Catherine Howard's downfall warned of the surveillance that now saturated court life, and Catherine Parr's printed voice foreshadowed the intellectual agency claimed by her stepdaughters Mary and Elizabeth. Six lives, diverse in fortune, together enlarged the horizon of female intervention in state affairs. As we reflect on this narrative, the sensory motifs that first framed Catherine of Aragon's arrival persist like leitmotifs in a motet. The scent of lavender laid among rushes returns with Jane Seymour's ladies scattering herbs in Hampton Court's nursery. The clang of the portcullis that dropped behind Anne Boleyn on her coronation eve reverberates again when Catherine Howard rides through Traitor's Gate. Beeswax smoke that once curled around Sarum Chant now mingles with the sharper tang of printer's ink as statutes roll off Fleet Street presses. These repeated impressions remind us that structural change is experienced at ground level through smell, sound, and texture before it is codified in parchment. The Tudor marriage project defies a single verdict. It fractured one communion, yet fostered another. It strengthened parliamentary procedure even as it magnified royal prerogative. It expanded diplomatic choice while narrowing the circle of trustworthy allies. As the Venetian envoy Lodovico Falier observed in 1542, this realm renovates itself by the very acts that seem to undo it. The six marriages prove this aphorism. As destruction and construction advance together, each queen's end clearing space for the next experiment in governance and belief. For modern listeners, the archival paths opened by these unions remain far from exhausted. Pipe roll expenditures can still be traced to iron fittings on monastic barns. Scratched notes in consistory registers await full collation. Holbein's surviving cartoons offer pigment samples ready for spectral analysis. Those who seek a fresh vantage might compare the music lists of the Chapel Royal across decades, measuring how liturgical melody shifted with each consort's preference. The material is there, patient as oak panels under layers of Tudor varnish, waiting for inquisitive hands. As this exploration closes, picture the long stone corridor of Whitehall rendered in twilight, torches sputtering against limestone polished by generations of silk shoes and spurred boots. At one end hangs Holbein's lost mural of the king, copied in countless miniatures. At the other stands the chapel door where choristers once rehearsed Escobar's motet at Catherine of Aragon's request. Between those points lies the echo of six distinct footsteps, each queen altering the pitch of the corridor without erasing the resonance of the last. To follow their sequence is to hear the story of a nation's remaking, audible still in statutes, stonework, and song. May this resonance invite you onward, into record offices where parchment crackles like frosted leaves, into libraries where marginalia flicker under ultraviolet lamps, into churches where dissolved brass indents outline lost memorials. The Tudor archive is vast, its silences as instructive as its surviving words. Pursue them, and you will find that the questions raised by six royal marriages continue to shape how we think about faith, sovereignty, and the fragile diplomacy of human alliance. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.